So the Parsha Vayetze begins with Yaakov's journey, as the Torah describes in first Pasuk, Perek Kavches, Pasuk Yud, Vayetze Yaakov mi Be'er Sheva, Vayelech Harona, he left for Be'er Sheva, went to Haran, and as is often the case with a Pasuk that seems to be very benign and straightforward, there's quite a bit to say, specifically because, as Rashi already points out, had the Pasuk just said, Vayelech Yaakov Harona, we would have known that he left, because you can't arrive somewhere without leaving where you were originally. And the Pasuk lays emphasis on Yaakov leaving Be'er Sheva. Rashi makes this famous comment that although we know that Yaakov left, but the Pasuk emphasizes that Yaakov left because Yetzias HaTzadiko Seroshem, it made a difference that he left. Not just the fact that he left. It's not the fact that's being recorded. It's the impact of that exit. The Beis Halevi addresses this issue in a sense, al derech hapshat, perhaps even more al derech hapshat, if one could say. And Beis Halevi prefaces by noting that whenever one goes from A to B, which is your standard journey, departure and destination, it can be for one of two reasons. Either the focus is getting to B, for which purpose one needs to leave A, or perhaps the focus is simply leaving A, and the destination in that circumstance is actually incidental or irrelevant, because the focus is more to get away from a certain place and not so much where it is that you would like to be. In Yaakov's case, actually, we have both of these themes together. His journey from Be'er Sheva to Haran had these two aspects, and it's very interesting to see, if one may say, the beginnings of the brisker discerning of really shnei dinim, of two aspects, of two dynamics that are occurring within what seems to be one thing. The Beis Halevi is the first of the Soloveitchiks, and it's a prime specialty to look at one entity and show you how what seems to be one thing is actually more than one thing going on. And that's exactly what the Beis Halevi is doing as he approaches this pasuk. For if we ask the question, what was Yaakov's purpose? What was his goal? Was it leaving Be'er Sheva, or was it arriving at Haran? The answer, of course, is yes. Because on the one hand, his mother has told him, your life is in danger, Esav wants to kill you, you've got to get away. From that point of view, wherever you go to, it doesn't really make a difference as long as it's anywhere, but here it's more leaving your current location that's the ikar. That said, at the end of Parshas Toldos, Yitzchak calls him and tells him that he wants him to get a wife from Lavan's house, in which case the focus is now not merely not being here, but actually being there in order to find someone. And therefore all of this is summed up now. We look with new eyes at this opening pasuk when it mentions the trip, both in terms of the point of departure and the destination. It's because each one of these was a key element within his journey. Vayetze Yaakov mi Be'er Sheva, from a certain point of view, there was a goal to get out of Be'er Sheva because of the Esav issue. And then the second aspect was Vayelech Harona, to get to Haran in order to find a wife as per Yitzchak's instructions. What's interesting is the Beis Halevi takes this one stage further. And the reason why is because we see from the Medrash that Parshas Vayetze is looked upon to a great degree as the Ma'ase Avos experience for Golos. This is when Yaakov is forced to leave Eretz Yisrael. And indeed, the Medrash darshans the word Charona from the word Charon Af, to a place of anger, to a place of difficulty, of turbulence. He leaves the familiar setting of Be'er Sheba and he goes to a place of Charon Af, Ki Hashem Hoga B'Yom Charon Apo. And it's interesting, therefore, as we see within this pasuk the micro experience for later for Golos. And then we ask the question, well, when we talk about the concept of Golos, of exile, what is the goal of Golos? And although the answer may seem straightforward, once again we will be confronted with two aspects of Golos. On the one hand, the more obvious is the experience of being in exile, that of being in a foreign place, and that's where the whatever is meant to happen in Golos happened. That's where the rectification happened. That's where the expiation and also the punishment aspect of Golos, to be somewhere else. But there's another element within Golos, and that is it's to get the Jewish people away from Eretz Yisrael. Not that they should be somewhere else, per se, but they shouldn't be in Eretz Yisrael. And the reason why is because if Golos is a response to wrongdoings of the Jewish people, the longer they stay in Israel and the longer they do not live and conduct themselves as they're meant to be doing, the worse it will be for them. And therefore, there's an aspect of Golos which is actually minimizing or containing damage done by the Jewish people in Eretz Yisrael. If they're in a state where they incur the penalty of Golos, it's actually imperative to expedite that, because the longer they stay, the more they're harming themselves, the land, and their future. Which is very interesting, because it turns out that within Golos itself, you have these two elements. You have, on the one hand, Vayetze Yaakov, which lays emphasis on leaving, as if to say, just to get out of Eretz Yisrael, not to cause any damage that, who knows how we could recover from it. And the second aspect, of course, is Vayelech Harona, the experience being in Chutz La'aretz and all of those Golos experiences. So, from the Masa Avos of Yaakov's two dynamics of his trip, to the Simon Labonim of the Jewish people's two dynamics within what it means to go into Golos. It occurred to me, perhaps to observe, that these two elements of Golos could be seen within the Nusach of the Tefillah, something that we say regularly, until we stop, we may not notice it. In Musaf Shalosh Regalim, so after we begin Atah B'chatanu, Vatitein Lanu, so then we say, Umipnei Chatoeinu, Galinu Me'artzeinu, V'nesrachaknu Me'alad Maseinu. So Galinu Me'artzeinu, exiled from our land, V'nesrachaknu Me'alad Maseinu, and distance from our land. And that sounds like two ways of saying the same thing. I mean, Golos is far away. And if it's near, it's not Golos. So what exactly is added, having said, Galina Me'artzeinu, in exile is exile. If it's not in Eretz Yisrael, it's already Chutz La'aretz. But we go on to say, V'nesrachaknu Me'alad Maseinu. Perhaps one may say that within these two expressions are the two elements of Golos that the Beis Halevi is talking about. On the one hand, Galina Me'artzeinu, right, the exile experience. But on the other hand, and aside from where we ended up, it was important to be removed from Eretz Yisrael. V'nesrachaknu Me'alad Maseinu, to be kept a safe distance away from being able to do more harm and live a more harmful existence within Eretz Yisrael. So these two aspects of Vayetze Yaakov Me'be'er Sheva, Vayelech Harona, I believe are reflected in those two phrases within Galinu Me'atzeinu and Nesrachaknu Me'alad Maseinu. So that's something to think about. Always a value to have further insight into the Nusach of Tefillah, especially when, depending on who's the Chazan, you may have a good time, amount of time to think about it. So, in any event, that's with regards to Pasuk Aleph. Now, we should note that everything we've said, notwithstanding, in terms of the elements of in play with Yaakov's trip, the Pasuk does seem to describe Yaakov in Pasuk Aleph, the first Pasuk of the Parsha that is, as if he's gotten to Haran. Vayetze Yaakov Me'be'er Sheva, Vayelech Harona. If we only saw that Pasuk, it seems that the Pasuk has described him as already having arrived there. Now, of course, the very next Pasuk, he's nowhere near there, because he's still Vayefka B'makom, wherever that is. It's true that the Gemara tells us in Maseches Chulin, and Rashi does quote this a bit further down the line, that he got to Haran and then came back. But the pashtus of the Pasuk means that he's on his way to Haran, but Vayelech Harona, it sounds a little bit like he's there. Vayelech Harona, he went to Haran. Not just towards Haran, to Haran, but it seems from the pashtus that that's not the case. So what are we to understand from those words in the opening pasuk? Of course, when Yaakov alights at the place, wherever that place is, he has his famous dream. Vayachalom, and vihine sula mutzav arza, v'shil magia shamayma, he has Yaakov's ladder. And of course, there's many perushim as to what that ladder represents. This is the only dream in the Torah where the interpretation is not in the Torah. So all we have is the dream, and there's many different perushim. But the pasuk, whatever the dream was, the pasuk does preface by telling us that it happened in a dream. And the question is, what is the significance of this prophetic experience of Yaakov being at night and it's in a dream? And indeed, the Medrash tells us to... It's a very interesting depiction, because it seems from Chazal that the sun set unusually early in order that Yaakov should sleep there and have this dream. And the Medrash brings a mashal of someone who came to the king's house, but the king felt that there was too much going on, the lights were disturbing him, so he said, this person has no rest. Dim the lights so they'll be able to go to sleep. And that was the situation with Yaakov. Here is Yaakov, he's come back to the Makom, to the Beis HaMikdash, wherever it is, and Hashem says, well, Yaakov is not going to have any rest here, and the lights have to be dimmed. And they were dimmed. And the sun set, and then Yaakov went to sleep. So there seems to be inherent value, and it's a very specific purpose in Yaakov, you know, going to sleep. It's an important part of what's happening here, and then having this dream. The Shem Shmuel gives a very interesting insight into what is happening here at the beginning of the Parsha. We have a principle. It's stated in the Talmud in Maseches Moed Katan, Daf Kafei Amud Aleph, with regards to Nevuah. And that is that Nevuah can only take place in Eretz Yisrael. Ein Nevuah Shorah B'chutz La'aretz. Now, if we ask the question, why is this so? We may answer in a general way, Eretz Yisrael is holier, and Nevuah is holy, and it's certainly not counterintuitive. But perhaps there's more to it than that. The truth is, says the Shem Shmuel, that Nevuah will always encounter a problem, because Nevuah is a spiritual medium, and the Navi is a physical being. And as long as the physical aspect of the Navi is active or dominant or significant, it will act as an impediment and an obstruction to the capacity to receive the Nevuah. And if you're looking to take a spiritual medium and project it onto a physical entity, and there doesn't seem to be enough of a point of fusion, enough of a point of connection. And that's an endemic problem when it comes to Nevuah. In Eretz Yisrael, the climate is right for Nevuah. Why? Because it's the nature of Eretz Yisrael that although it is physically a land like other lands, but the physical aspect of existence in Eretz Yisrael is more attuned to spirituality. That's why there are mitzvahs that apply to the land. Mitzvahs hatluyos ba'aretz. All of the physical aspects of Eretz Yisrael themselves are not inconducive to spirituality. They can much more easily be harnessed and enlisted in the cause of Ruchnius. And that is why if the Navi lives in Eretz Yisrael, so he lives in an environment where the physical can be attuned to the spiritual, so that allows his physical to be attuned to the spiritual, and that allows him, even as a physical person, to receive the spiritual medium of Nevuah. In Chutz La'aretz, where the physical is that much more physical and largely unredeemed, it's not as synchronized with spiritual pursuits, therefore the Navi, the physical being of the Navi, remains incompatible with Nevuah. That's a very interesting explanation as to why it is that Nevuah only exists within Eretz Yisrael, as the Gemara says in Moed Katan there. Now, the truth is, there is a little bit more to the situation than this. because when we talk about nevuah, so actually the pasuk at the end of Parshas Baalosecha, it's in Bamidbar and Perek Yud Beis, discusses more than one type of nevuah, actually. As Miriam and Aaron, they're talking about Moshe, why did he have to separate from his wife? Is he different than us? And the answer is he was different than them. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu first tells them how nevuah normally works, and then shows them how Moshe Rabbeinu is an exception to all of those rules, right? Lo chein avdi Moshe, he's very different, pe'al pe'a daber bo, but originally the way HaKadosh Baruch Hu presents the possibilities for nevuah, he actually mentions two things. Firstly, he says, I will appear to him, will be known to him in a vision, some apparition, bamar'ah. And then says, bachalom adaberbo, I'll speak to him in a dream. So it sounds like there are two avenues, and this is within, quote-unquote, normal nevi'im, general nevi'im, not Moshe Rabbeinu yet. Either bamar'ah elav esvada, and bachalom adaberbo, the vision or the dream. Now, what's interesting is we are inclined to say that whenever a nevuah will always take place in a dream. That's the notion. But the truth is, we see from this pasuk that there are two possibilities, either the vision or the dream. It is true that even if it's the vision, it will be in some type of trance-like state, right? The physical faculties will be suspended largely. But nonetheless, we're not talking about a dream that takes place when he's asleep. He's actually awake, but somehow yet he's able to apprehend this form of vision. The question is, does it make a difference how the nevuah comes? And are there ever any situations where you could have one without the other? Or are there just two ways of getting to the same result? And maybe the two avenues themselves are identical or not significantly dissimilar to each other. Well, the Gemara in Maseches Chagiga on Daf Hey discusses the pasuk in the end of the end of Vayelech, which says the famous Hester Ponim, Vanochi Haster Aster Ponai Bayomahu. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu talks about a certain time where there'll be Hester Ponim and there'll be, I guess, lack of communication. But then the Gemara goes on to say, and Rava said this, even in the time of Hester Ponim, Bachalom Adaberbo. Those are the words of the Gemara. So Hester Ponim sounds like communication will cease, but nonetheless, Afa Pichein, says Rava, Bachalom Adaberbo. The question is, what exactly is the intent of the Gemara here, and what is ceasing, and why can Bachalom Adaberbo still occur, even in the time of Hester Ponim, it seems. The Shemishmuel explains that nevuah stops at a time of Hester Ponim, because if Hashem, so to speak, hides his face from the person, that means there once again is this disconnect between the physicality of the person and the message coming from Hashem. His physical makeup becomes an obstruction, becomes an impediment. However, of the two types of nevuah, one of them can still happen. And the reason why is because the difference between a person when he's awake or when he's asleep is that when he is awake, his spiritual element and physical element are much more connected. When he's asleep, they disconnect. I mean, that's why we make a brocha of Tchiyas HaMeisim in the morning, Elokai Neshomish Inosatabi, Ata Lachzirabi, every day. The Gemara itself says that sleep is a 60th of death itself, because there's a fundamental loosening and of the spiritual faculties with the physical faculties. And therefore, even in a time of Hester Ponim, which sounds like there should be no more nevuah anymore because Hashem is not communicating, but that doesn't mean that there can be no form of communication. It means there's no waking communication, because that means it's impossible for someone, even a Navi, when he's awake, for his physical faculties to be put to the side, to be negated. But even under those circumstances, when he's sleeping, afal pichein b'chalom adaberbo, because then there is the additional loosening, there's the additional disconnecting of the of the spiritual from the physical, and that allows him to receive nevuah in a dream under those circumstances. Thus far is all statements from the Gemara, but the Shem Yishmuel suggests that as surely as we see from the Gemara, that even in a time of Hester Ponim, there's no vision nevuah, but there can be nevuah in a dream, even under those conditions. So the Shem Yishmuel understands that when we say that there's no nevuah in Chutz La'aretz, because there's only nevuah in only Eretz Yisrael has the climate, it could be that that is also with regards to waking nevuah. But nevuah in a dream, b'chaloma daberbo, can exist within Chutz La'aretz. That is to say, even as we saw that in the time of Hester Ponim, when communication is lessened, but it only impacts on the waking nevuah, but not on the sleeping nevuah, so too the much discussed distinction between Eretz Yisrael and Chutz La'aretz is also with regards to a nevuah while awake, but not while asleep. And acharei hadvarim ha'ele, let us see how that affects the events and the beginning of Parshas Vayetze. For if we ask the question, as Yaakov is leaving, which form of nevuah is more appropriate for him as he's leaving Eretz Yisrael? Is it more appropriate? HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants to communicate with him. He will have this vision of the ladder and the promise, and it's a very important meeting. What conditions are appropriate? What is the form that nevuah should take? So for this, we need to preface just one more point. Yaakov sees on his ladder Malachei Elokim Olim V'yardim Bo. As he has this dream, he sees Malachim are going up and down. And as we've mentioned many times, and Rashi himself raises the issue, not only gives the explanation, but raises the issue. Malachim, everybody knows, what goes up must come down. Unless you're an angel. In which case, if you begin from up, so then it's more what goes down must come up. Because the point of departure is up. And therefore, for the pasuk to describe Malachim as Olim V'Yordim is actually inaccurate. The order is reversed. It should have been Yordim V'Olim. First they go down, then they come up. And that is why Rashi's response to this question, which is very well known, is that it was nothing short of two different groups of Malachim. So one group was going up, and a different group was going down. Who's going up? The Malachim of Eretz Yisrael. A person has different Malachim. As he goes from Eretz Yisrael to Chutz La'aretz, or Yaakov Avinu, certainly, and therefore the Malachim of Eretz Yisrael were ascending, because he's now leaving, and the Malachim of Chutz La'aretz are now accompanying him. There's just one question. Yaakov is not in Chutz La'aretz yet. He couldn't be more in Eretz Yisrael. If he's on the place of the Beis HaMikdash, that qualifies as being in Eretz Yisrael. Why are the Malachim changing already if he's nowhere near the border? Which is a good shaila. They seem to be a little eager. He's nowhere near, he hasn't left the border yet. The truth is that a very similar phenomenon is perceived at the end of the parsha, because as he's coming back towards Eretz Yisrael, he also has a similar experience. Vayifgu bo malachei Elokim. There's malachim. Who are those malachim? Rashi says they're malachim of Eretz Yisrael. They came to meet him. And then there's two groups now. Unlike when he left, when the Eretz Yisrael malachim left before, right, Olim before the Chutz La'aretz malachim came down, as he's coming back, they're both there together. There is actually an overlap for various reasons as to why the different directions have slightly different experiences. But once again, he calls that place Machanaim because he sees the Malachim of Eretz Yisrael, the Malachim of Chutz La'aretz. But as Meforshim point out, Ramban asks the question, at that time he's nowhere near Eretz Yisrael. He has yet to send Malachim to Seir, to Esav, which is on his way into Eretz Yisrael. And this is already before that. The Maharal in the Gur Aryeh and other Mefarshim explain that when it comes to certain spiritual matters, a person's location is not defined by where they are currently, but it is defined by where they're headed. Because location in spiritual terms is a function of vector, and therefore if a person is headed in a certain way, that is the definition of the person, even if he's not there yet. And the implications are that when Yaakov, in the beginning of Parshas Vayetze, he's on the site of the Beis Hamikdash, but he's leaving. He's on the way out. He's leaving towards Haran. And because he's leaving towards Haran, the Malachim are already changing now, because he is treated as someone who is leaving, if not left. And the reverse is true in the end of Parshas Vayetze. As he comes back, he's not yet in Eretz Yisrael, quite true. But he's on the way, already the Malachim are changing. And that's, of course, an important concept in its own right when it comes to spiritual matters. A person is judged in accordance with the direction that they're headed in. What are the implications for the type of nevuah that he will receive? We've noted that when we say that nevuah doesn't exist in Chutz La'aretz, that means nevuah, when one is awake, doesn't exist in Chutz La'aretz. But b'chaloma daber bo, even if it's geographically the equivalent of Hester Ponim, but even in Hester Ponim, b'chaloma daber bo. If, as we see from the Malachim changing, that Yaakov at this stage is already considered to be going to Chutz La'aretz, if not in Chutz La'aretz, the appropriate experience for him to receive the nevuah is that of a dream. Because b'chaloma daber bo is a Chutz La'aretz way of receiving nevuah, and he's considered to be in Chutz La'aretz now. And therefore, we understand on the one hand why the Torah emphasizes that the nevuah came in a dream. Moreover, it gives us further insight as to why the opening pasuk actually describes him as if he's already gone to Haran, which was one of our questions. Vayetze Yaakov mi'Be'er Sheva, vayelach Haran. He went to Haran. The pasuk describes it as if he's already there. As far as his nevuah is concerned, it is as if he's already there, because he's judged in terms of the direction that he's going. So he's rated as if he's in Haran, and his nevuah comes in the form of a chalom. And indeed, says the Shem Yishmuel, this is the deeper understanding of that parable that we find in the Midrash, of the one who visits the king's palace, and the king says, you know, if the lights are on, it will disturb him. So he turned the lights off, and then that was the desired situation. What that means is, if the lights are on, because Yaakov is headed to Chutz La'aretz, that means that as long as the lights are on and he is awake, it will disturb, it will interfere with the nevuah that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wishes to give to him, because he can only receive it when his spiritual faculties have been disconnected now from the physical in the dream, and therefore the lights had to be dimmed in order for him to go to sleep, and then HaKadosh Baruch Hu was able to talk to him. And that is why we find the opposite number is in the end of Parshas Vayetze, as he's coming back to Eretz Yisrael, whereas on the way out he was only able to see these malachim going up and down in a dream, because being headed towards Chutz La'aretz, he receives nevuah in a Chutz La'aretz way, but when he's on his way back to Eretz Yisrael, he's not in a dream as he sees the malachim. He can see them while he's awake, because he's heading back to Eretz Yisrael, and he's able to receive nevuah b'mar'ah. So this is the explanation of the Shem Yishmuel. It gives a very different dimension to a lot of these psukim that we're familiar with. We went to Be'er Sheva, and he was dreaming, and he saw Malachim, and the beginning and the end. These are the observations of the Shem Yishmuel. I think it's very interesting to note, perhaps as a PS, that Avraham Avinu has a prophetic experience in the Bris Ben Abisarim, in Parshas Lech Lecha. And there we find something very interesting, because if we ask the question, was he awake, was he asleep, it actually happens that in the Bris Ben Abisarim, Avraham Avinu fell asleep halfway through. That's how the pasuk describes it. Because originally HaKadosh Baruch Hu was speaking to him in the beginning of Perek Tesvav, and he's already telling him things, in Ko Yezar Echa, Usporas HaKochavim. And then at a certain point, it says, "V'tardema nafla al Avram." Avram fell asleep. And then Hashem continued talking to him. So it's very interesting, because there we ask, what was the more appropriate state for Avram to be in. If he's awake, let him be awake until the end. If he should be asleep, let him be asleep from the beginning. What exactly, I think it's an unusual situation that it's halfway through. He was put to sleep. It's true, according to many Rishonim, based on the Seder Olam, the first group of Psukim and the second group of Psukim did not happen at the same time at all, in which case they're two completely different experiences. But what seems to be the understanding of Rashi is that it's one flow, all of this happened at the same time, and therefore why was he awake from Pasuk Aleph to Zion, and then he fell asleep at some point after that for the second part. But based on the explanation of the Shemesh Shmuel, I think we can at least get further insight. It's topic related, or to borrow an expression, it's case sensitive, because the first elements that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was talking to him about in the beginning of Tesvav were all about Eretz Yisrael, about the future of the Jewish people. He will give him Eretz Yisrael. So, because it was about Eretz Yisrael, so he received the Nevuah in an Eretz Yisrael type of way, which is Bamar'ah, with the full Nevuah, even while he was awake. But when HaKadosh Baruch Hu came to talk to him about the Golus, so he received Nevuah in a Golustika Ofen, in a Golus compatible way. Golus is a time of Hestaponim. In Hestaponim, there's no communication except the Chalom HaDaberbo, and therefore, approximately halfway through the Bris Mene Besarim, he was put to sleep. And he received the balance of the prophecy, but that related to the exile in that sleep-like state. That perhaps is part of what is behind the change that took place halfway through the Bris Mene Besarim. Okay, so Yaakov has received his Nevuah, he's on his way, and he gets to Haran, and he goes to a well, and what does he see? So, Pasuk Kaftes, Vayisa Yaakov Raglav, Vayelech Arz B'nei Kedem, and he sees, as he gets to Haran, Hinei Be'er Basadeh, you've got this well, and there's all those flocks around, there's this enormous rock on the middle of the well, they've all got to get there in order to move it away. Okay, so Yaakov approaches, Pasuk Dalet, Vayom Elahem, Yaakov. So Yaakov says to the shepherds, Achai, Me'ayin Atem, where are you from? Vayomu, Me'charon Anachtu, we're from Haran. Very good, so far so good, that's exactly where he wants to be. Vayom Elahem, Yudatim, is Lavan ben Nachor. Do you know Lavan? Yes, Vayom Yadano. Very nice. Vayom Elahem, Shalom lo, how is he? Vayom Shalom, he's doing fine. And here is Rachel, Ba'a Im Hatzo. Okay, in other words, any further information, you can just talk to Rachel. But he's doing okay. So far, it's nice and friendly. Where are you from? Do you know Lavan? How is he? So far, so good. At this point, Yaakov now becomes rather to the point with these shepherds. Vayomer. Hein od hayom gadol. Still plenty of time left in the day. It's not a time for gathering the flock. Hashkuatso, uluchuro, the water of the flock. What are you doing, just idling around? And they explain to him that we can't until everyone's here because this is an enormous rock on the well. And many Mefarshim have wondered, what exactly is Yaakov doing as he castigates these shepherds? I think the conversation was going nicely in the beginning. As long as he was asking, how are you, and how's love one, and that's fine. But all of a sudden, he takes the moral high ground with them and begins to chastise them and to rebuke them. What are you idling around for? I don't know. I mean, most people don't take kindly to a complete stranger that's coming up to them, and especially if he doesn't, it's none of his business. Especially as the Pasuk has already told us, and this is actually an interesting question, Pasuk Beis and Pasuk Gimel describe the fact that this rock was on the well and no one could move it unless they were all there. And it says that Yaakov saw this. I mean, Pasuk Beis begins, Vayarvi, they bear bas. He saw there was this well. Which means Yaakov actually should have been able to work it out. Isn't that a desired way to try and understand the situation? If you see there's a well, you see there's a rock, you see that it takes all of them to lift it off, so why are you then approaching them and saying, well, why are you just wasting your time? Why are you idling around? So it's an interesting shaila. What's behind the musr of Yaakov here? Seems to be maybe slightly out of place. The truth of the matter is, as much as that question is an obvious question in terms of Yaakov's words to them, of rebuke. But really we need to go a bit further back in the conversation and yet ask another question. Namely, there's three stages to Yaakov's conversation with them. Number one, where are you from? From Haran. So far, so good. Number two, do you know Lavan? Yes. How is he? He's doing just fine. There's his daughter Rachel. Stage three, why are you wasting your time? Now, our question so far has been on, you know, the third part of this conversation, why is he rebuking them? But the truth is, the second part also needs to be understood. What is Yaakov's goal here? He's looking to get to Lavan's house. So essentially, what does he need from these shepherds? The conversation should have gone like this. My brothers, where are you from? From Haran. So far, so good. Do you know Lavan? Yes. Question three should have been, can you tell me where he lives? He starts schmoozing with them. How is he? Find out for yourself. Go and visit him. Does it make a difference that the shepherds think he's okay? Hashalom, though. How's he doing? It's at this point, he doesn't seem to be serving his purpose. Find out where Lavan is, and you can have all the time in the world to find out exactly how he is. That's a good shaila. Well, in order to understand a bit of the background to this exchange with Yaakov and the shepherds, we've got to start with the end of Parshas Toldos. Because Yaakov is heading to Lavan's house, and he actually does not know what to expect. And by that we mean, it's very interesting, as a famous Rashi at the end of Parshas told us, Perek Kavches Pasuk Hei, Vayishlach Yitzhak Es Yaakov, Vayelech Padena Aram. So Yaakov went to who? To Padena Aram. Who is there? El Lavan, Ben Besuel Ha'arami. To Lavan, Achi Rivka, brother Rivka, Ein Yaakov Esav, who's the mother of Yaakov Esav. And of course, Rashi at this point is saying, once you tell me, or even just remind me who Lavan is, because we haven't heard from him in a while, but you don't need to remind me who Rivka is. I mean, I know that Rivka is the mother of Yaakov and Esau. So for the Pasuk to, it just seems to be going in a circle unnecessarily. Lavan was the brother of Rivka. Rivka, of course, the mother of Yaakov and Esau. Of course she's the mother of Yaakov and Esau. So that's what the Parshas told us is all about. And Rashi makes this famous comment, Eini yodea ma melamdenu. I don't know what this is teaching us. So the good news is, Rashi doesn't know. So we can feel better. But what exactly does Rashi mean to say? The pashtus of Rashi really is just to highlight the issue. And by inference, by the way, that means that if Rashi doesn't say that, then anywhere else, we do know, or Rashi does know, what it's teaching us. But here, Ein Yodea Ma Melamdenu. And of course, that becomes the Rashi challenge now. All of the post-Rashi Mefarshim are looking to explain, what is it, Melamdenu? But Rashi still doesn't know. The Be'er Basodeh, one of the Mefarshi Rashi, Rav Menachem Danun, he has a very interesting comment on this Rashi. I don't think it's Pshat. I think it's Drash. And apparently there exists such a concept of Drash within Rashi, unless he thought it was Pshat. When Rashi says, Ein yodea ma melamdenu, he's not saying, I'm not sure what the Pasuk is teaching us. He's saying, I'm not sure what Lavan's relationship to Rivka is teaching us. And what does that mean? Yaakov is on his way to Lavan. What does he know about Lavan? Very little. One thing we do know, and this is the principle, the very well-known concept in the Gemara. The mother, her brother, will have an affinity with her children. Right? The sons of the mother are very similar to her brother. That's often the case. That's the rule of thumb. Habonim domim la'achei ha'em. Fine. How many brothers does Rivka have? One. How many sons does she have? Two. What's Lavan like? It really depends which of her two sons he's like, because they couldn't be more dissimilar to each other. So, in order to get a bit of a fix on the type of person that Lavan is, so Yaakov doesn't know. And the reason why Yaakov doesn't know is because Rivka, who's the sister of Lavan, she's the mother of Yaakov and Esav. So the question is, which one of them is the spiritual heir, so to speak, of Lavan? Which one of them has more commonality? And Yaakov doesn't know. And that therefore when Rashi says, commenting on the words, Ein Yaakov Esav, Ein Yodeh Mamelam Deinu, what that means is, because she is the mother both of Yaakov and of Esav, so I don't know what this teaches us about Lavan. Because is he really Yaakov's uncle, or is he Esav's uncle? And in fact, according to the Netziv, that's really part of what Lavan responded to when Yaakov finally came into his house and told him Kol Advar Ma'ele, told him his whole life story. And Lavan's response is, Ach Atzmi Ubasari Ata. You're my relative. Ach. Now the word Ach, as we know, is a miut. It's restrictive. It's exclusive. What's he coming to exclude? Or who is he coming to exclude? Says in Netziv, he heard Yaakov's whole story with Esav, and Lavan says, you know, you two are brothers, but I can't see anything that he has in common with me. I think that you're the only one that I feel related to. Ach atmi v'sari atav, of the two of you, you are my family. I don't know where he came from. Of course, the opposite is the case. But Yaakov at this stage doesn't know. And therefore he wishes to get as much of an insight into Lavan's character as he can before he arrives. He needs to know what to expect. And therefore, the Kliokar explains that this is what's behind his exchange with the shepherds. In other words, he can't ask Lavan what type of person he is, for obvious reasons. He also can't necessarily ask the shepherds what type of person Lavan is. That's too much of a direct question. The closest he can get to getting a sense of the type of person Lavan is to ask the shepherds, how is he? How's he doing? Because it's a very open question, but you never know what the response it may bring. He's fishing, in a sense. Because he says, Hashalom, no, is he okay? There could be any number of responses, which could be helpful to Yaakov. They may say, he's doing fantastic. I mean, he runs the crime syndicate here in Haran, and we all love him. Or maybe they'll say, no, he's the biggest tzaddik in town, and we hate him. Or something. It can provoke a reaction from, as if he's looking at the shepherds as almost like a survey, as a sounding board from their reaction to find out the type of person Lavan is. So Hashalom lo could give him valuable information depending on their response. Well, what is their response? So they come back and they say, he's doing fine. Which is nice, but it seems that it doesn't yet help Yaakov. And the reason why is because, is he fine because he's a good person and they admire him? Or is he fine, is he doing well because he's a bad person and they're all bad people? Or maybe he's a tzaddik Yaakov still doesn't know what to make of the fact that they say Lavan is doing okay. Is he doing okay because he's not a good person and therefore they're happy to have him there? Yisro was not doing well because Yisro rejected Avodah Zarah and they made his life a misery. So if you asked how Yisro was doing, you'd get a sense of exactly the type of person he was. So you ask how Lavan is doing and they say he's doing well. Adkan from the Kliyakar, but I think there's room to add just one more thing. Namely, it's such an open reply. Shalom, he's okay. You still need to find out what type of person he is, but in order to do so, you need to find out what type of people the shepherds are. Because if they're good people and he's okay, that bodes well for him. If they're bad people and okay, that's a bad sign for him. And therefore, Yaakov wants to know, could it be that he's really a good person, but they don't mind him being a good person in their midst, unlike the people of Midian. And therefore, they're at ease with him. They're not so great, but he's a good person, and they can live together. Or maybe it's specifically because he himself is also not such a good person. That's why they get on so well. If he was a tzaddik, maybe they'd reject him. How can I know? So I think there's only one thing for Yaakov left to do, and that is to become a tzaddik. That is to say, he proceeds to test how they react to a person criticizing them. Because if they say, it's none of your business and let us do what we want and we don't like your kind here, etc. and so forth, then he'll know that if they're at peace with Lavan, there's something wrong with Lavan. And I think this, as a, inspired in a sense by the Kliyokar, this is what Yaakov is doing as he rebukes them. He's rebuking them because he wants to see how they respond to rebuke. If they reject rebuke, but they accept Lavan, that's a bad sign for Lavan. But if they accept rebuke, then who knows, maybe Lavan is also a holy person, but they're okay with him, just like they're okay with Yaakov. And therefore, he takes a hard line with them. Why are you wasting your time? There's so much time left. He starts ordering them around. Hashkua Satzon, water the flock. He knows the answer. I think he knows the answer. Pasuk Beis and Gimel, he's seen that they can't. But he wants to see how they react to his words of rebuke. And in the event, so to speak, to his disappointment, they react very amiably. They don't get upset with him, it seems. They just explain themselves. We can't, right? No, one would have anticipated perhaps that they would tell him to, you know, show him the door. Who are you to, right? Who are you to come and question our ways? But they don't do that. They just explain themselves in a very good-natured way, which actually is a disappointment for Yaakov, because now he has no idea what the type of person Lavan is, because maybe Lavan's a good person, but they get on well with everyone. I mean, they got on well with Yaakov, and he just gave them rebuke. And that is why we see that he proceeds to Lavan's house essentially none the wiser, as is evidenced by the fact that as he introduces himself through Rivka, he introduces himself as Achi Aviha, her brother's father, her father's brother, and Ben Rivka, Rivka's son. And Rashi famously tells us that what he's saying is, however you want to play it, I can do that. If you want to be a trickster, Achi Bar Amos, so I can also do that. If you want to be kosher, I can also be kosher. The fact that Yaakov is ready for both scenarios means that he wasn't able to get a sense of the type of person Lavan was from the Roam, but I do believe that's what he was trying to do, as he asked them, number one, how Lavan is, and number two, why they're wasting their time and not watering the sheep. As we get towards the end of the Parsha, and Yaakov, at a certain point, has had enough, and runs away. And in Perek Lamed Aleph Pasuk Yutes, as he runs away, and his family runs away with him, so Rachel also runs away with them and takes something with her. And that's in Pasuk Yutes of Perek Lamed Aleph, V'lavan halach ligzoz, as Sona Lavan goes to shear his sheep, v'tignov Rachel es hatrafim asher la'aviha. She steals these trafim. Now what are the trafim? Some type of Avodah Zarah, maybe some other divining tools, certainly nothing kosher. And Rachel takes them, and a lot happens as a result of her taking them, as we know. But she does. One of the elements of fallout here from Rachel taking the Trafim is recorded in the Medrash Tanchuma in Parshas Miketz. And the Medrash there is commenting at the point where the brothers, all the brothers, have been to Yosef, the end of Miketz, and then they all leave, and as we know, the cup was planted in there in Binyamin's bag, and they search and they find it, and it's in Binyamin's baggage. And everyone's very upset. They're upset with Binyamin. And the Medrash says, Hayu omdim umechavti leBinyamin al kaseifa. They were hitting him on his shoulders. For omrimlo ganva, you're a thief. Oh, they thought he did it on some level. Ganva barad ganva, sir, you're a thief, and your mother was a thief. Biashtanu, you've brought shame to us. Ben imcha, you are indeed your mother's son. Kach bisha imcha es avinu, because your mother brought shame on her father when she also stole. So like mother like son. Uvishvil osan hamakos shehiku bekaseifav, says the Medrash, in the merit of sustaining those blows on his shoulders, zocha shetishre shchina bein kaseifav. Binyamin merited that the divine presence should dwell bein kaseifav, as the pasuk says in Parshas with a sabracha, chofeif alav kol hayom, uvein kesefav shachem. The Beis HaMikdash, or portion of it, is in this section of Binyamin, and that's called Bein Kesefav Shachem. All of that came as a result of this, or was a result of this episode. Of course, Ein HaMedrash Hazeh Omer Ela Darsheni. We need to understand, firstly, what exactly do the brothers mean by connecting these two? No discussion about any fault is ever enhanced by stating that it's hereditary. And that doesn't really help anyone. So they say, you're a thief and your mother was a thief. What's the shaykhus between these two things? It's also interesting that it's very much of the essence that when it says that they delivered blows to him, it says how you makana so al kesefov. They hit him on his shoulders. Which is very interesting because hitting someone on the shoulder doesn't really sound like a punishing blow. Most people are hit on the shoulders as an act of congratulations. Or between their shoulders if they're choking. But as an assault, it's very specific. And what does it mean? So Mefarshim explain. There exists a concept, there's many different words in the Lashon HaKodesh actually for friendship, as we know. Reim, Ahuvim. And there's a type of friend which is called a Yidid. What is the meaning of the word Yidid? So what's interesting is, most friendships, it's the way of things. Even if there's a good relationship, but they're not total. They're not an absolute all-out connection. And what that means, for example, is you may like the other person very much. It doesn't mean you like everything about them. You may like spending time with them, but it doesn't mean you like spending all of your time with them. And moreover, it could be that there are other people who don't like them and that doesn't bother you because you do. In other words, it doesn't have that absolutist element to it. And in fact, there's an expression in Chazal for this type of relationship, which is predominantly positive, but there are some aspects which are either neutral or maybe even negative, and that's life. The stronger hand is the yamin, which represents the ikr, and the weaker hand is the left. And therefore, Chazal say about certain relationships which are generally close, but not totally, they are referred to as smol docha v'yamin mekareves. The left hand pushes aside, and the right hand brings close. And what that means is there are certain aspects which are pushed aside, but by and large, it's positive. The smol pushes aside, but the right hand brings close. However, there is a certain type of relationship, some people have this, where it really is absolute, meaning it's everything. There's nothing negative about that one perceives in the other. And therefore, it's all embracing. That is the connotation of the word yidid. Because yidid means a friend, but actually yidid essentially is the word yad twice, meaning both hands are equal. As surely as, right, yidid is yad yad. There's no left here. They're both equally embracing. It represents this all-embracing relationship. This is the madrega of Binyamin. This is the characteristic of Binyamin. And indeed, Binyamin is the only one in the Chumash referred to as Yidid Hashem. He has this relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Yidid Hashem. And there are certain aspects of Binyamin. It's interesting, of course, each of the Shvatim are unique. But Binyamin has certain elements to him that the others don't have. He's the only one born in Eretz Yisrael of the Shvatim. He's also the only one of the Shvatim that in no capacity ever submitted to Esav in that Maisa Avos scenario. Because when Yaakov bowed down and his children bowed down, Binyamin didn't bow down. He didn't bow down because he was not yet born. He hadn't entered the frame yet when Yaakov was submitting to Esav. And indeed, this is something that reverberates later on, because the Medrash tells us, it's the Yalkut Shimoni and Esther, that one of Binyamin's descendants took up the legacy of Binyamin, Mordechai. Lo yichrav, lo yishtachaveh. Everyone's bowing down to Haman, and apparently it's okay, or they thought it was okay, or made it okay, and Mordechai said, it's not okay. Lo yichrav, lo yishtachaveh. Oh my lo! So Haman says to Mordechai, Hari matzino avosech l'shtachavu l'avosai. This is legitimate. Your ancestors bow down to my ancestor. All of the Shvatim, right, they all bow down to Esav. Amar lo, says Mordechai, not all, not my ancestor. Binyamin Avi, my father Binyamin, bime'e imo haya. He was yet inside his mother. Velo hishtachava v'ani ben v'no. Shene emar ish yemini. Mordechai is ish yemini. V'kashem shelo kara avi. Just like he didn't bow down, so I'm not bowing down. That represents this relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu that will not be violated or compromised for anything. That's Yadid. That's Yad Yad. Now, the roots of this relationship, interestingly, of Binyamin's characteristic of Yad Yad, it's very extreme and all-embracing and all-encompassing, begin with Rachel, actually. This is really the insight as to what it means for Rachel to take the trophim, for Rachel to take these objects of Avodah Zarah or whatever they were. In other words, if one considers the situation, Yaakov and Rachel and the family, they're looking to run away. Part of running away is you don't really wish to give the other one incentive to run after you. It's the worst time in the world to steal his trophim, because it pretty much guarantees that he will run after you. It's not the diplomatic move. Okay, leave him. Zalzain. It's been that way. He's been that way for always. And Rachel is this is the first time I'm actually getting away from him. These have to go. I'm sorry, it's unacceptable. And then there were consequences, because when he ran after them, he said, Lama ganavtes Elohai. So he was baited. It doesn't seem to be the advisable move. And Rachel doesn't make calculations. When the brothers thought that Binyamin had stolen the cup from Yosef, they didn't think it was an act of theft, out of greed for money. They saw this as the legacy of Rachel, as if to say it's the most ill-advised confiscation one could possibly imagine. Here is the leader of Egypt, along comes Binyamin, he's a zealot. He sees this cup and says, you know, that's not acceptable for anyone, really, so I'm taking it. And he got them all into trouble. So they understood that he took it for religious reasons, because he wished to prevent this heathen Egyptian from divining in an immoral fashion. So he took his cup. It's the most ill-advised plan in the world. And apparently Binyamin didn't care, just like his mother didn't care. And that's why they said, you are a thief, and so was your mother. Meaning this theft, it's like, it's a Rachel Imenu type of theft. We understand that you took the cup in the same way that your mother took the trephim. But you should have perhaps thought about the broader political implications for such a thing. But I guess you don't do that. And that's why the Medrash says they hit him on his shoulders, right? They hit him between the shoulders. What are they looking to do? To damage him? No. They're looking to loosen the connection. The shoulders are where the two hands are connected. They see Binyamin as a Yad Yad person. In other words, he has two right hands. And therefore the notion of hitting him between the shoulders is there should be some type of separation. There's a reason why you've got a right hand and a left hand. And this was a left-handed situation. You shouldn't have gone in with the right hand. You should have just turned a blind eye. Okay, so he's not going to be the firmest person in Egypt. It's not your problem, but you made it your problem. That's the significance of what it means to hit him between the shoulders. And in the merit of sustaining those blows, the Medrash says that he got the Beis HaMikdash, because although in that instance he hadn't stolen the cup, but he did represent this Yad Yad, whereby it is all-embracing, and he therefore became the ideal person for the Beis HaMikdash to exist on an ongoing basis in his territory. That indeed is the legacy of Binyamin, which begins with Rachel herself. We'll leave it over there.